Hello, and welcome to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, August 12th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. We'll start with today's weather. Today will be sunny with clouds, breezy and hot with a high of 96 degrees. Tonight it'll be breezy early, partly cloudy with a low of 68 degrees. Saturday will be mostly sunny and very warm with a high of 91 degrees. And now we turn to today's local news stories. Reynolds asks court to lift abortion injunction. Fetal heartbeat bill was halted by a judge in 2018. Aaron Murphy reports from Des Moines. Abortion would be illegal in Iowa after 6 weeks of pregnancy, often before the woman knows she is pregnant, if Governor Kim Reynolds' request to the Iowa courts is granted. Reynolds filed a motion Thursday asking a state court to lift an injunction on legislation passed in 2018 that would have banned abortions in Iowa at 6 weeks. The bill, passed by the Republican-led Iowa legislature and signed into law by Reynolds, was halted at the time by a district judge who cited a previous Iowa Supreme Court ruling that had negated a required 24-hour waiting period for an abortion. But since the U.S. Supreme Court and Iowa Supreme Court earlier this year issued rulings that effectively repealed a pregnant person's right to abortion access, Reynolds is asking the state courts to now lift the injunction on the six-week ban. The historic U.S. Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe has given us a new hope and pathway forward to challenge the Iowa court's previous decision, Reynolds said in a statement. Life and death are determined by a person's heartbeat, and I believe that includes our unborn children. As long as I'm governor, I will stand up for the sanctity of life and fight to protect the precious and innocent unborn lives. The 2018 legislation is known as the Fetal Heartbeat Bill, so named by its supporters because they say it bans abortions after a fetus's heartbeat can be detected. However, medical experts say the heart is not developed at 6 weeks, and ultrasound machines at that point in a pregnancy are not actually detecting a heartbeat. According to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, what is actually heard at 6 weeks is the ultrasound machine translating electronic impulses that signify cardiac activity. It is clinically inaccurate to use the word heartbeat to describe the sound that can be heard on ultrasound in very early pregnancy. In fact, there are no chambers of the heart developed at the early stage in pregnancy that this word is used to describe, so there is no recognizable heartbeat, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists say. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller, a Democrat, has declined to represent the state in the case, citing his opposition to the legislation. Reynolds, a Republican, and the state are being represented instead by Iowa conservative attorney Alan Ostergren and Alliance Defending Freedom, a national conservative legal organization that, according to its website, works to protect religious freedom, free speech, the sanctity of life, parental rights, and God's design for marriage and family. Iowa Democrats criticized Reynolds' approach. During a virtual news conference Thursday, state lawmaker Jennifer Confirst, the leader of the minority party Democrats in the Iowa House, noted public polling consistently shows a majority of Iowans and Americans believe abortion should be legal in some or most cases, and that Kansas voters recently voted down a proposed amendment that would have said their state's constitution does not protect an individual's right to abortion services. Iowa Republican state lawmakers have started the process of proposing a state constitutional amendment similar to the one that was voted down in Kansas. If approved again in 2023 or 2024, that proposal would be decided by Iowa voters as early as the 2024 elections. We know that Iowa Republicans want the most extreme abortion legislation they can get in the state. So rather than waiting until the legislature comes back in January and having an honest conversation about what abortion law looks like in Iowa and what reproductive freedom looks like in this state, Republicans are running to the courts and trying to have them circumvent the will of the people and address it that way. It's another example of politics over people, Confirst said. This is way extreme. We've seen voters across the country reject this, and because the governor knows voters would reject this here in Iowa, she's playing politics. Neglected rabbits recovered from Sergeant Bluff home. Nick Heitrek reports from Sioux City. The discovery of a house full of neglected rabbits has led the Siouxland Humane Society's rabbit population to multiply faster than, well, you know what. The Humane Society received 13 rabbits at its shelter at 115 Triview Avenue Wednesday after Sergeant Bluff police recovered them from a house in Sergeant Bluff. The rabbits of various ages had been abandoned and were living in, quote, deplorable conditions, unquote, running loose inside the house with no food or water for several days, said Kelly Erie, the Humane Society's public relations and volunteer manager. Officers were expected to return to the home and round up more rabbits they were unable to catch Wednesday. Two of the rabbits are undergoing veterinary care, and four others have been placed in foster care because they were in poor condition. The rest are available for adoption and have pushed the Humane Society past its capacity to house smaller animals that aren't dogs or cats. The Humane Society already was housing a rabbit, four ferrets, and eight guinea pigs. The shelter is way past full capacity, overfull with these rabbits and lots of other small critters, Erie said in a news release. There are no empty kennels, and we had to go out and purchase additional rabbit cages. Erie said charges are pending against the rabbit's owners. The Sergeant Bluff Police Department continues to investigate the case. Group holding week-long prayer gathering. Dolly A. Butch reports from Sioux City. Volunteers from Time to Revive have been visiting various locations around Sioux City this week to pray, offer support, and encourage others to worship Jesus Christ. Time to Revive partners with a local church in each community to bring believers together across denominational lines and inspire them to obey the Great Commission to go and make disciples, according to the Richardson, Texas nonprofit's website. The organization began a week-long prayer gathering in Sioux City on Monday in partnership with Heartland Community Baptist Church. Ed Riesing, a member of Heartland and volunteer with Time to Revive, said the group has prayed at a number of locations around town, including the Woodbury County Sheriff's Office, Sioux City Police Department, and elementary and middle schools. Time to Revive even stopped by the Journal's office on Thursday afternoon to offer information, support, and prayers to staff. We are here to support them. There's a remnant of people that want to help them do right. We know that there are many things working against them. Much negativity, said Riesing, who said reaction to Time to Revive volunteers' visits has been overwhelmingly positive. In a letter, Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott asked local churches to join together in unity for the prayer gathering, which runs through Sunday. The letter was posted to Heartland's social media accounts on Tuesday. As mayor of Sioux City, Iowa, I am thankful for the local churches who are here to meet the tangible and spiritual needs of our community, Scott said in the letter. During this time, we will be praying for the businesses, government, education, media, arts and entertainment, families, and churches in the Siouxland area. It is my desire that all aspects of our community flourish and know that with God and through faithful prayer, all things are possible. The goal of this week-long prayer gathering is for the local body of Christ to cultivate a heart for their own community. In doing so, with God's help, the church will be able to see and meet the tangible and spiritual needs of individuals during these challenging times. When asked by a Journal reporter Thursday about the letter, Scott, who is a member of Heartland, said his pastor is very involved in the process. He didn't express any concern that people of other faiths might feel excluded and noted that the letter was not written on city stationery, nor were any city funds expended. I've written letters for Muslim activities and other things. I don't use city stationery. I'm not concerned. I would be supportive of other activities, he said. I think I have a right as a private citizen to mail that. I am the mayor. I think I have that right, so I exercise that right. Riesing said the group has also been hosting a prayer time and a revival meeting at Heartland daily, beginning at 7 p.m. He said more than 300 people have turned out at a time and that the event has grown each night. He said more evangelization work is planned in October. We're working towards 1,500 workers to be involved in that in the community, he said. A hidden treasure turns 25. Adams Homestead to celebrate with variety of activities. Earl Horlick reports from North Sioux City. As park manager for Adams Homestead and Nature Preserve, Jody Moat's responsibilities include everything from collecting turkey tail feathers for art projects to wrangling up buffalo chips for a distance throwing contest. But she draws the line at milking any cows. "I refuse to add cow milking to my daily routine," she said, pointing to the menagerie of critters at Sunny's Acres. "You'll see other types of farm animals, but no milking cows." A 1,500-acre park located in the Missouri River Basin outside of North Sioux City, Adams Homestead and Nature Preserve will be the site for several family-friendly activities from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday, commemorating its 25th anniversary as a state park. First established by Stephen Searles Adams in 1872, the homestead includes the family's farmhouse, a log cabin, the Lamont Country School, Stavanger Lutheran, as well as Sunny's Acres, which also doubles as a working farm. In addition, the land is home to several interpretive exhibits and more than 10 miles of hiking and biking trails. Envisioning it as a place where people could enjoy the natural world, Stephen Searles Adams' granddaughters, Mary and Maud Adams, donated the homestead to the state of South Dakota in 1984. It received the state park designation in August 1997. Mary and Maud called Adams Homestead and Nature Preserve a place for inner renewal. Moats explained, "The visitors who come here call it a hidden treasure." Indeed, the facility saw a huge spike in attendance at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. "We never closed, and it was easy to be socially distanced at a 1,500-acre park," Moats said. "Ever since, more and more people have been visiting us." Which is why Moats is so excited for the Adams Homestead and Nature Preserve's 25th anniversary celebration. All day Saturday, kids will be able to make ink out of berries while using turkey feathers as pens. At the same time, dads can test their agility by throwing buffalo chips, while moms can work on their pitching arm during a rubber chicken throwing contest. "Rubber chickens are easier and safer to throw than real ones," Moats noted. Other activities will include rope making, candle making, corn shelling, Dutch oven and threshing machine demonstrations. "We'll even have a homemade pie contest," Moats said. "Contestants can bring in their pies at 10:30 a.m. and judging will start at 1:30 p.m. These are types of events which were common when Stephen Searles Adams was still around. They were also activities that would probably meet the approval of his granddaughters. "I never met Maud Adams, who died in 1995, but I did know Mary Adams, who died in 2009. Moats, who began working at the park 22 years ago, explained, "To this day, I still think of Mary." Looking over the 1,500-acre park, Moats is certain that the Adams family would be proud. "Mary and Maud envisioned a place where people could learn about our prairie past," she said. "Adams Homestead and Nature Preserve has become an oasis for people wanting to unwind in a peaceful park that is right off of the Interstate 29. And finally, Briarcliff signs articulation agreement with WITCC. Briarcliff University has signed a new articulation agreement with Western Iowa Tech Community College, Briarcliff announced on Thursday. The agreement will allow students with an Associate of Arts degree at WITCC to pursue a Bachelor of Arts degree in Accounting, Business Administration, Finance, International Business, Marketing, and Sports Management at Briarcliff University, according to a press release from Briarcliff. Briarcliff and WITCC are also joined in several other transfer agreements, covering fields of study including education, behavior analysis, psychology, biology, nursing, social work, and criminal justice. WITCC reached a similar agreement with Morningside University, Morningside College at the time, 5 years ago, which allowed WITCC students to transition to Morningside to advance their education. A similar agreement was reached with Wayne State College more than 3 years ago. And now we move to national and world news. AG seeks to unseal Trump warrant. From Washington, the Justice Department is asking a federal court to unseal the warrant the FBI used to search the Mar-a-Lago estate of former President Donald Trump, Attorney General Merrick Garland said Thursday, acknowledging extraordinary public interest in the case about classified records. The announcement came the same day an armed man in body armor tried to breach a security screening area at an FBI field office, then fled and was injured in an exchange of gunfire in an hours-long standoff with law enforcement that persisted into late afternoon, authorities said. The Justice Department's request is striking because such documents traditionally remain sealed during a pending investigation, but the department appeared to recognize that its silence since the search had created a vacuum for bitter verbal attacks by Trump and his allies, and Garland wanted to provide the FBI's side for what led to the action. The public's clear and powerful intent in understanding what occurred under these circumstances weighs heavily in favor of unsealing, said a motion filed in federal court in Florida on Thursday seeking the unsealing. Should the warrant be released, the request is now with the judge, and Trump can object. It could disclose potentially unflattering information about the former president and his handling of sensitive government documents right as he prepares for another run for the White House. During his successful 2016 campaign, he pointed frequently to an FBI investigation into his Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton, over whether she mishandled classified information. It was unclear how much information would be included in the documents if made public, or if they would encompass an FBI affidavit that would presumably lay out a detailed factual basis for the search. To obtain a search warrant, federal authorities must prove to a judge that probable cause exists to believe that a crime was committed. Neither Trump nor the FBI has said anything about what documents the FBI might have recovered, but the former president complained anew Thursday about the search. Trump, who for years has lambasted the FBI and sought to sow distrust among his supporters in its decisions, said the warrant was served and the search conducted despite his cooperation with the Justice Department. In a post to his Truth Social platform, Trump said his attorneys and representatives were cooperating fully prior to the search, and that government officials could have had whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted, if we had it. FBI and Justice Department policy cautions against discussing ongoing investigations, both to protect the integrity of probes and to avoid unfairly maligning someone who is being scrutinized, but winds up ultimately not being charged. That's especially true in the case of search warrants, where supporting court papers routinely are kept secret as the investigation proceeds. In this case, though, Garland cited the fact that Trump himself had provided the first public confirmation of the FBI search as his right. The Justice Department, in its new filing, also said disclosing information about it now would not harm the court's functions. In a hastily scheduled public statement delivered from the Justice Department podium, Garland appeared to acknowledge the unusual nature of the department's request as he declined to take questions or provide any substantive details about the FBI's investigation. Much of our work is by necessity conducted out of the public eye. We do that to protect the constitutional rights of all Americans and to protect the integrity of our investigations, he said. Federal law, long-standing department rules, and our ethical obligations prevent me from providing further details as to the basis of the search at this time. He said he personally approved the search warrant, a step he said was part of an ongoing investigation into the discovery of classified White House records recovered from Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Palm Beach, Florida, earlier this year. The National Archives had asked the department to investigate after saying that classified records were found in 15 boxes of records that it retrieved from the estate. Garland condemned verbal attacks on FBI and Justice Department personnel over the search. Some Republican allies of Trump have called for the FBI to be defunded. I will not stand by, silently, when their integrity is unfairly attacked, Garland said of federal law enforcement agents, calling them dedicated, patriotic public servants. There have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country since federal agents searched Mar-a-Lago. Thursday's confrontation with the armed man began at the FBI's Cincinnati office. Federal officials said the man attempted to breach the visitor screening area at the FBI office and fled when agents confronted him. After fleeing onto Interstate 71, he was spotted by a trooper and fired shots as the trooper pursued him, said Lieutenant Nathan Dennis, an Ohio State Highway Patrol spokesperson. The suspect left the interstate north of Cincinnati and abandoned his car on rural roads, where he exchanged gunfire with police. The man had unknown injuries, but no one else was hurt as of mid-afternoon Thursday, the patrol said. CDC relaxes guidelines. Health agency ditches rules for quarantining social distancing. From New York. The nation's top public health agency relaxed its COVID-19 guidelines Thursday, dropping the recommendation that Americans quarantine themselves if they come into close contact with an infected person. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also said people no longer need to stay at least 6 feet away from others. The changes, which come more than 2.5 years after the start of the pandemic, are driven by a recognition that an estimated 95% of Americans 16 and older have acquired some level of immunity, either from being vaccinated or infected, agency officials said. The current conditions of this pandemic are very different from those of the last 2 years, said the CDC's Greta Mazzetti, an author of the guidelines. Many places around the country long ago abandoned social distancing and other once common precautions, but some of the changes could be particularly important for schools, which resume classes this month in many parts of the country. Perhaps the biggest education-related change is the end of the recommendation that schools do routine daily testing, although that practice can be reinstated in certain situations during a surge in infections, officials said. The CDC also dropped a test-to-stay recommendation, which said students exposed to COVID-19 could regularly test instead of quarantining at home to keep attending school. With no quarantine recommendation anymore, the testing option disappeared too. Masks continue to be recommended in areas where community transmission is deemed high, or if a person is considered at high risk of severe illness. School districts across the U.S. have scaled back their COVID-19 precautions in recent weeks, even before the latest guidance was issued. Some have promised a return to pre-pandemic schooling. Masks will be optional in most districts when classes resume this fall. And some of the nation's largest districts have dialed back or eliminated COVID-19 testing requirements. Public schools in Los Angeles are ending weekly COVID-19 tests, instead making at-home tests available to families, the district announced last week. Some others have moved away from test-to-stay programs that became unmanageable during surges of the Omicron variant last school year. The American Federation of Teachers, one of the nation's largest teachers' unions, said it welcomes the guidance. Every educator and every parent starts every school year with great hope, and this year even more so, President Randy Weingarten said. Economy shows positive signs. Gas prices dipped below $4 a gallon, and producer prices fell. From Dallas. Gasoline prices have dipped under $4 for the first time in more than 5 months. Good news for consumers who are struggling with high prices for many other essentials. AAA said the national average for a gallon of regular was $3.99 on Thursday, down from the mid-June record of $5.02. However, that's still about 80 cents higher than the average a year ago. Energy is a key factor in the cost of many goods and services, and falling prices for gas, airline tickets, and clothes are giving consumers a bit of relief, although inflation is still close to a four-decade high. Oil prices began rising in mid-2020 as economies recovered from the initial shock of the pandemic. They rose again when the U.S. and allies announced sanctions against Russian oil. Also on Thursday, the Labor Department said the number of Americans who signed up for unemployment benefits rose last week to the highest level since November, though the U.S. job market continues to show signs of strength. Applications for jobless aid climbed by 14,000 to 262,000 and now have risen 5 out of the last 6 weeks, the department reported. The four-week average for claims, which smooths out weekly ups and downs, rose by 4,500 to 252,000, also the highest since November. Meanwhile, prices at the wholesale level fell from June to July, the first month-to-month drop in more than 2 years, and a sign that some of the U.S. economy's inflationary pressures cooled last month. Thursday's report from the Labor Department showed that the Producer Price Index, which measures inflation before it reaches consumers, declined 0.5% in July. It was the first monthly drop since April 2020 and was down from a sharp 1% increase from May to June. and average long-term U.S. mortgage rates soared this week in a continued volatile market as the key 30-year loan rate jumped back over 5%. Mortgage buyer Freddie Mac reports that the 30-year rate rose from 5.22% from 4.99% last week. By contrast, the rate stood at 2.87% a year ago. Last week, the 30-year rate fell below 5% for the first time in 4 months, days after the Federal Reserve raised its benchmark interest rate by a hefty 0.75 point in its most aggressive drive in over 3 decades to tame record-high inflation. It was the central bank's second such increase in less than 2 months. Judge calls mistrial in Flint water case. Plaintiff's lawyer, one juror prevented win versus engineering firms. From Detroit, a judge declared a mistrial Thursday after jurors said they couldn't reach a unanimous verdict in a dispute over whether two engineering firms should bear some responsibility for Flint's lead-contaminated water. Veolia North America and Lockwood, Andrews & Newman, known as LAN, were accused of not doing enough to get Flint to treat the highly corrosive water or to urge a return to a regional water supplier. The 8-person jury met for roughly 7 days, after hearing evidence for months. The jury first signaled on July 28th that it couldn't reach a verdict before taking a planned 11-day break. The group returned to work Tuesday. Further deliberations will only result in stress and anxiety with no unanimous decision without someone having to surrender their honest convictions, solely for the purpose of returning a verdict, the jury said in a new note Thursday. U.S. Magistrate Judge David Grand declared a mistrial, rejecting a request by lawyers for 4 children to allow a verdict that's less than unanimous. Pardon me, I think that's a typo. U.S. Magistrate Judge David Grand declared a mistrial, rejecting a request by lawyers to allow a verdict that's less than unanimous. This is not a focus group, Grand said. The trial centered on the engineering firms and the effects of lead on the children, not all Flint residents. But the result was being closely watched because there are other cases pending against Veolia and LAN. EU's ban on Russian coal imports in effect. Western nations pledge more military aid to Ukraine. From Kyiv, Ukraine. On a day of give and take, Western nations made more pledges to send arms to Ukraine, while the European Union's full ban on Russian coal imports kicked in Thursday, amid intelligence claims that sanctions against Moscow were hurting its defense exports. Germany, seen early in Russia's invasion as a lackadaisical Ukrainian ally, is making what Chancellor Olaf Scholz described as a massive break with its past by sending weapons to the war-ravaged country. Scholz said Germany is shipping arms, a great, great many, sweeping and very effective. His government has approved military exports of at least $710 million and plans to provide further financial aid to Ukraine, the Chancellor said. In Copenhagen, Britain and Denmark also made commitments to help Ukraine's defense against Russia's invasion, which has devastated the nation and reverberated across the world. We will not let you down, Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said as she opened a day-long international donors conference. Denmark said a new contribution of $113 million would push the total amount of funding from the small northern nation of 5.8 million people to over $500 million. In comparison, Ukraine's top donor, the United States, has committed $9.1 billion in security aid since Russian troops invaded on February 24th. Once again, you are listening to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, August 12th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Wayne A. Splinter Momsen, 76, of Sioux City, passed away unexpectedly at his residence. Services will be at 1:30 p.m. on Saturday at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel in Sioux City. Visitation will be held at 12:30 p.m. until the time of the service. A luncheon will follow. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery at a later date. Online condolences may be sent to meyerbroschapels.com. Wayne was born in Hartley, Iowa on February 20, 1946, to Roy and Margaret Ficken Splinter. After Roy died, Margaret married Ed Momsen, and he adopted Wayne and Russell. Wayne was drafted into the U.S. Army on November 2, 1965, and served during the Vietnam conflict. Wayne married Kathy Little on September 23, 1983, in South Sioux City. To this union, twin daughters Kayla and Kelsey were born. Wayne worked at the Sioux City Foundry, Plant 2, in South Sioux City for 46 years before retiring. He was an exceptionally good woodworker, craftsman, calligrapher, artist, guitar player, and wonderful father. He loved his daughters, family, working with wood, and playing guitar. Wayne was preceded in death by his parents, Roy Splinter and Margaret Momsen, one stepfather, Ed Momsen, and two sisters, Mary and Alice. Joseph L. Joe Gramoskas, 77, of Sioux City, died Tuesday, August 9th. Services will be August 20th at 1 p.m. at Christy Smith Funeral Homes, Morningside Chapel, at 1801 Morningside Avenue. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time at the funeral home. James A. Johnson, 80, of Sioux City, died Wednesday, August 3rd. Services will be August 12th at 4 p.m. at Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City, with military honors. Public visitation will be August 12th from 3 to 5 p.m. at the funeral home. Diana L. Cooper, 70, of Sioux City, died Saturday, August 6th. Services will be August 15th at 7 p.m. at Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City at 4125 Orleans Avenue. Visitation will be August 15th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Richard L. Dick McCormick, 78, of Dakota City, died Tuesday, August 9th. Services will be August 13th at 11 a.m. at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Jackson, Nebraska. Burial will take place August 15th at 1 p.m. at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Cemetery in Verdigris, Nebraska. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time at the church. Arrangements are with Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home. Anne E. Hildebrandt, 61, of North Sioux City, died Saturday, August 6th. Services will be August 12th at 10 a.m. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time at the funeral home. Thomas F. Collier, 81, of Sioux City, died Tuesday, August 9th. Services will be August 16th at 7 p.m. at Christy Smith Funeral Homes, Morningside Chapel. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time at the funeral home. Joan Marie Graff Sampson, 90, of Annawa, Iowa, died Monday, August 8th. Services will be August 15th at 10:30 a.m. at St. John Catholic Church in Onawa. Burial will follow the services at Onawa Cemetery in Onawa. Visitation will be August 15th from 9:30 to 10:15 a.m. at the church. Arrangements are with Gosler Funeral Home and Monuments in Onawa. Live stream of service available at the funeral home's website. And finally, Robert L. Bob Hickson, 70, of Sioux City, died Tuesday, August 9th. Services will be August 16th at 10:30 a.m. at Wesley United Methodist Church in Sioux City. The burial will follow the services at Logan Park Cemetery. Visitation will be August 15th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the church. Arrangements with Meyer Brothers, Morningside Chapel. Now a few more stories in national and world news. Trump's bond with GOP deepens after recent events. From New York, Donald Trump's pick for governor in the swing state of Wisconsin easily defeated a favorite of the Republican establishment. In Connecticut, the state that launched the Bush family and its brand of compassionate conservatism, a fiery Senate contender who promoted Trump's election lies upset the state's GOP-endorsed candidate. Meanwhile, in Washington, Republicans ranging from Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell to conspiracy theorist Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene defended Trump against an unprecedented FBI search. And that was just this week. The rapid developments crystallized the former president's singular status atop a party he has spent the past 7 years breaking down and rebuilding in his image. Facing mounting legal vulnerabilities, and considering another presidential run. He needs support from the party to maintain his political career. But whether they like it or not, many in the party also need Trump, whose endorsement has proven crucial for those seeking to advance to the November ballot. For a pretty good stretch, it felt like the Trump movement was losing more ground than it was gaining, said Georgian Republican Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, who is urging his party to move past Trump. But now, he said, Trump is benefiting from an incredibly swift tailwind. The Republican response to the FBI search of Trump's Florida estate this week was an especially stark example of how the party is keeping Trump nearby. Some of the Republicans considering challenges to Trump in a 2024 presidential primary, such as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, were among those defending him. Even long-established Trump critics like Maryland Governor Larry Hogan questioned the search, pressing for details about its circumstances. But even before the FBI showed up at Mar-a-Lago, Trump was gaining momentum in his post-presidential effort to shape the GOP. In all, nearly 180 Trump-endorsed candidates up and down the ballot have won their primaries since May, while fewer than 20 have lost. Only 2 of the 10 House Republicans who supported Trump's impeachment after the January 6th insurrection are expected back in Congress next year. Representative Jamie Herrera Butler, a Republican from Washington who conceded defeat after her Tuesday primary, was the latest to fall. Leading Trump antagonist Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming, is at risk of joining her next week. Climate bill game changer in boosting green energy. From Washington. After decades of inaction in the face of escalating natural disasters and sustained global warming, Congress hopes to make clean energy so cheap in all aspects of life that it's nearly irresistible. The House is poised to pass a transformative bill Friday that would provide the most spending to fight climate change by any one nation ever in a single push. Friday's anticipated action comes 34 years after a top scientist grabbed headlines warning Congress about the dangers of global warming. In the decades since, there have been 308 weather disasters that have each cost the nation at least $1 billion. The record for the hottest year has been broken 10 times, and wildfires have burned an area larger than Texas. The crux of the long-delayed bill, singularly pushed by Democrats in a closely divided Congress, is to use incentives to spur investors to accelerate the expansion of clean energy, such as wind and solar power, speeding the transition away from the oil, coal, and gas that largely cause climate change. The United States has put the most heat-trapping gases into the air, burning more inexpensive, dirty fuels than any other country. But the nearly $375 billion in climate incentives in the Inflation Reduction Act are designed to make the already plummeting costs of renewable energy substantially lower at home, on the highways, and in the factory. Together, these could help shrink U.S. carbon emissions by about 2/5 by 2030 and should chop emissions from electricity by as much as 80%. Experts say it isn't enough, but it's a big start. This legislation is a true game changer. It will create jobs, lower costs, increase U.S. competitiveness, reduce air pollution, said former Vice President Al Gore, who held his first global warming hearing 40 years ago. The momentum that will come out of this legislation cannot be underestimated. The U.S. action could spur other nations to do more, especially China and India, the two largest carbon emitters, along with the U.S. That, in turn, could lower prices for renewable energy globally, experts said. Because of the specific legislative process in which this compromise was formed, which limits it to budget-related actions, the bill does not regulate greenhouse gas emissions, but deals mainly in spending, most of it through tax credits, as well as rebates to industry, consumers, and utilities. And in related news, we're back, baby! New bill boosts U.S. climate credibility. Again, from Washington. After a moment when hopes dimmed that the United States could become an international leader on climate change, legislation that Congress is poised to approve could rejuvenate the country's reputation and bolster its efforts to push other nations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions more quickly. the head-snapping turn of events, which has generated a joyful case of whiplash among Democrats and environmentalists, is a reminder of how domestic politics is intertwined with worldwide diplomacy. Advocates feared that last month's breakdown in negotiations in Congress had undermined efforts to limit the catastrophic effects of global warming. Now they're energized by the opportunity to tout an unprecedented U.S. success. "This says we're back, baby," said Jennifer Turner, who works on international climate issues as director of the Woodrow Wilson Center's China Environment Forum in Washington. The legislation, which also has provisions on taxes and prescription drugs, includes about $375 billion over the next decade for clean energy development and financial incentives for buying electric cars, installing solar panels, and weaning the power grid off fossil fuels. Although the proposals were downsized during difficult negotiations, it's the single biggest investment in climate change in U.S. history, and a significant shift from years of inaction that limited Washington's clout overseas. The Senate passed the legislation on Sunday, and the House is expected to approve it on Friday. Then it goes to President Joe Biden for his signature. Poor nations remain concerned that rich countries like the United States have not fulfilled financial commitments to help them cope with global warming and transition to clean energy, something the legislation does not address. But Biden can still point to it as evidence that the U.S. political system can address the world's most pressing problems. "Our ability to have credibility on the global stage depends on our ability to deliver at home," said Ali Zaidi, the White House Deputy National Climate Advisor. "We are the pace car. That helps other people go faster and faster." And finally, state police officers to work in Uvalde this fall. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says the State Department of Public Safety will be a law enforcement presence throughout the Uvalde Consolidated Independent School District in the upcoming school year. The DPS security presence of more than 30 state police officers was requested by Uvalde CISD Superintendent Hal Harrell, Abbott said in a news release. The 2022-23 school year will begin September 6th. The announcement Wednesday comes less than a month after a Texas House committee report revealed DPS made up 91 of the 376 law enforcement officers who responded to the May 24 shooting that killed 19 children and two teachers at Robb Elementary School. It was the deadliest school shooting in Texas history. "As a new school year begins, we must ensure students, parents, and all dedicated school personnel can look forward to new opportunities to learn and grow," Abbott wrote in the release. "Texas will keep working to provide all available support and resources to the Uvalde community as they continue to heal." Law enforcement has been heavily criticized for the response in Uvalde. 18 minutes passed between the first call to 911 and when police confronted the shooter, who fired at least 142 rounds, according to a timeline from Texas Department of Public Safety Director Steve McCraw. "We know going back to school will be especially challenging for many in Uvalde," McCraw said in the news release. "The Texas Department of Public Safety is committed to working with the Uvalde Consolidated Independent School District to ensure each child, parent, and teacher feels safe and protected during this difficult time. There is no task more important than this." And now we go to these local sports stories. Ninth-inning heroics gives X's win over Monarchs. Rafaela's three-run blast lifts Sioux City in series finale. Will Glocker reports from Sioux City. Ademar Rafaela hit a walk-off three-run home run in the bottom of the ninth inning, and the Sioux City Explorers beat the Kansas City Monarchs 5-2 to take the rubber game of the series. The first five innings were a scoreless pitcher's duel between Patrick Ledette and Nick Belzer, but the Kansas City Monarchs plated the first run. It came in the sixth when Kevin Santa reached on an error to lead off the inning. A triple by Robson scored Santa. David Thompson singled home Robson, and the Monarchs took a 2-0 lead. Nick Belzer for the Monarchs threw six scoreless innings, but received no decision. The former Explorers gave up four hits, four walks, and struck out seven. In the seventh, the Explorers cut the Monarch lead in half. Jack Kelly reached on a three-base error and scored when Danny Amaral reached on another error to make it 2-1. Explorer starter Patrick Laudette pitched 7 innings and gave up 2 runs, 1 earned. The lefty allowed 8 hits and 1 walk and struck out 3. In the bottom of the ninth, trailing by a run, Danny Amaral reached on a 1-out single. He scored to tie the game on a Danny Vasquez base hit to left field. After a strikeout and with 2 outs in the inning, Adamar Rafaela blasted a 3-run walk-off homer over the right field wall to give the X's another comeback win. With the win, Sioux City takes the rubber games of the series from Kansas City and wins the season series from the Monarchs 7-5. After an off day on Thursday, the Explorers will head to Winnipeg for a 3-game series at Shaw Park beginning on Friday at 6:30 p.m. And in these other sports briefs, Morningside takes top spot in GPAC coaches poll. From Sioux City, the defending NAIA national champion Morningside Mustangs earned 10 of the 11 first-place votes in the Great Plains Athletic Conference's preseason coaches poll. Morningside tallied 100 points to hold first place in the conference's preseason rankings. Northwestern, a semifinalist team from a year ago, received the lone remaining first-place vote, tallying 91 total points. Dort tied for third in the conference a season ago and is picked third by the coaches to start the year, receiving 77 points. Concordia, who tied Dort with a 7-3 record last season, is picked fourth with 72 points. Briarcliff received 26 points, placing them 10th of 11 schools in the conference. The Chargers, which are at 3-8 overall or 3-7 in conference last season, were 6 points behind Jamestown and 7 behind Hastings. The lone program behind Briarcliff in the standings is Mount Marty, as the Lancers head into their second season as a football program. The conference season kicks off September 3rd, and the top 2 programs, Morningside and Northwestern, are set to face off in Sioux City. In volleyball, Red Raiders picked 3rd in preseason GPAC poll, again from Sioux City. Coming off an NAIA quarterfinals appearance, the Northwestern volleyball team is picked 3rd in the Great Plains Athletic Conference's preseason coaches poll. Northwestern received 98 total points, including 3 first-place votes, to start the season ranked 3rd. Jamestown is picked 1st with 115 points and 6 first-place votes, and Midland 2nd with 107 points and 3 first-place votes. 7 GPAC teams made last season's NAIA tournament, with 3 making the quarterfinals and 1, Jamestown, making the semifinals. Dort made the tournament last season and is picked 7th in the conference to start the 2022 campaign, receiving 63 votes. Briarcliff and Morningside were picked 10th and 11th, respectively, having separated by 2 points. The Chargers received 28 points, while the Mustangs received 26. Concordia, Nebraska, College of St. Mary, and Dakota Wesleyan were the other 3 GPAC schools who made the NAIA tournament last season and are picked 4th through 6th, respectively. And finally, in football, 3 Coyotes land on Hero Sports preseason team. From Vermilion, South Dakota seniors Dalton Godfrey and Alex Jensen, along with junior Brock Morganson, were selected to the preseason All-American list by Hero Sports, announced by the site on Thursday. Godfrey and Jensen were named to the second team, while Morganson earned 3rd. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, August 12th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks for listening.